Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. Yesterday, we were privileged to have on with us a special guest, Nicole D. Porter, Director of Advocacy with the Sentencing Project out of Texas, although Nicole does reside in Washington, D.C. Nicole spoke about her knowledge, extensive experience, and her advocacy work throughout the years and in various places across the country. To briefly update those of you who were unable to listen in yesterday, Nicole is a director of advocacy program, again, out of Texas. She has extensive experience and knowledge in the areas of criminal justice, and she was named a civil rights leader by Essence magazine for the work that she has done to eliminate the mass incarceration. Since joining the Sentencing Project in 2009, Ms. Porter's work has been cited in several major media outlets, including the New York Times, Washington Post, and National Public Radio. So we're going to have Nicole on with us to speak more about the work that she does. For those of you who were not available yesterday or able to be with us, you can catch up on Ms. Porter's work today. So let's welcome Nicole Porter, again, Director of the Sentencing Project from Texas. And Nicole, are you on with us?
I am. Good morning.
How are you today?
I'm doing okay. Thank you for asking.
Okay. Would you like to just speak a little bit more about what we spoke about yesterday, some of the statistics too? You mentioned quite a few different things that are going on with the Sentencing Project, and also some of the statistics.
Sure. I mean, I don't know where to start, I suppose. Yesterday we spoke a bit about life imprisonment and how that's impacting folks in Massachusetts, but also nationally. I think what's encouraging about the conversation, despite how sober it is that there is a growing conversation nationally around the need to address life imprisonment. And clearly there's a lot of work going on in Massachusetts, and we touched on that already. But I was on a call earlier this week, and there was a Massachusetts-based activists involved in that call, as well as advocates from other states, including Michigan, Illinois, Iowa, California, Alabama, and New York, in several states. And these are all folks who are currently engaged in ongoing advocacy to change laws and to build public momentum and popular momentum to change those laws. So it's encouraging. I think one of the events that was discussed on that call that I mentioned is that in New York, there have been several advocacy days in Albany, the state capital, to emphasize support to change laws and revisit extreme sentencing around parole and the lack of parole. And several hundred people, 500 people, showed up in Albany earlier this month to emphasize the support for that in the state of New York and call on lawmakers to change the laws there. And similarly, there have been, you know, a strong show of support in state capitals around the country, in California and Pennsylvania, where these laws are also very extreme. And I know that there's similar support in Massachusetts as well. So I think that despite how challenging it is to have these conversations and the level of work that needs to be done to open up, viable remedies for release for lifers and other sentenced to very extreme sentences, there is growing momentum around this, and that's evidenced by the activity and the activism that's happening around the country, including in Massachusetts.
Well, I wanted to mention anyone that really wants to know more about Nicole and the work she's doing, you can go on the internet and just type in Nicole Porter's interviews, and it will bring up everything, including the interviews that we had yesterday and also the one that we have today later on. I wanted to let you know, Nicole, quite a few people on Facebook and in all the different groups were really impressed with your interview. And I will say there are the, let me just read a few of them. The fuel, this is the fuel, it's called FUEL, F-U-E-L. It's Families United to End Life Without Parole. And there's also a group that's called, which I initially started, it's run by Nancy Roberts, and it's called End Life Without Parole. There's the Mothers Against, the Mothers, the Letter Writing Advocates, Mothers with Sons in Prisons, Wives, Daughters, I believe it is, Black Lives Matter, Inmate Support Incarcerated. There were quite a few people that responded to this. And one of the things is that, right now with the prison reform goals, and this is the main focus, what you're talking about now, one of the main focuses is what's going to happen with the penal system. What are your thoughts on how they're going to respond and how the prisoners are going to be treated with this goal coming up? Because the prison, they will be losing a lot of money if this goes through with this mass incarceration.
I think that poses a challenge to advocates who are calling on an end to mass incarceration and want to, you know, reduce prison populations. And hopefully, you know, these changes can result in closing down prisons. That's what I hope is possible given this work, and those are conversations I want to be involved in. And a few years ago, and this work needs to be updated, I was publishing list of announced prison closures and also plans to repurpose those prisons outside of incarceration uses. So I think that number one, a starting place is that, you know, state budgets and state and local economies shouldn't be predicated on incarceration and disappearing residents away, particularly given what we know the impact of incarceration to be on disadvantaged communities and particularly communities of color. So, and looking at changes to this, transformational changes that can, you know, lead to declines in state prison populations and hopefully prison closures, offers an opportunity that advocates with stakeholders, including lawmakers and other state and local government officials, can engage in, you know, opportunity-based discussions around what comes next for these communities. Holding on to incarceration as an economic driver in terms of, you know, jobs for correctional officers or the other, the other ways that prisons fuel local economies isn't an excuse to not engage in change and not to respond to concerns and critiques around the level of incarceration and demanding something better for our state, for our communities, including communities where prisons are currently sited, but that, you know, those communities as well as the sending communities where many residents in prison come from deserve something better. And these conversations can lay the foundation for what that something better looks like. Because it's not okay for lawmakers and you know, correctional officials to just keep prisons open because they help support local economies. That's not an okay response to the need to challenge and address the levels of incarceration we have and the harm that incarceration does.
And there's a lot of these things that are going on that, unfortunately, is going to be, as you say, is going to be a barrier to a lot of the advocates. However, as I mentioned yesterday, with a lot of these lawmakers starting to go to these countries and looking at how they operate and the success stories that they have with their penal system and the work that they do with the prisoners there, hopefully they'll do it over here. You know, this is the mass incarceration is beyond what anyone can imagine, because prisoners are being double-celled, and many prisoners are choosing to stay in maximum secure prisons just so that they don't have to go to a medium and be stuck in a cell with another male, especially if they're serving a long sentence or a life sentence.
Yeah, I do think, you know, the work of taking U.S.-based correctional officials to European countries to look at different ways that prisons can be run. It has helped to influence the conversation here. And I know that corrections commissioners in South Dakota and Pennsylvania are trying to incorporate what they've learned on these international visits into their own practices in, you know, running their state prison systems here. So hopefully that will have an impact. I think, though, that what we should center as part of these conversations is reducing admissions to prison as a first step, and then also to shortening prison stays, because one of the drivers of incarceration in the United States is that since the early 80s, the likelihood that residents will come in contact with police has gone up, and once residents come in contact with the police, the likelihood that they'll be charged with the crime has gone up, and once charged with the crime, the likelihood that they'll go to prison has gone up, and the changes just accumulate. So the likelihood of going to prison has gone up, and then the likelihood of a longer time served in prison has increased also since the 80s. So it is helpful of U.S. officials going to Germany and Norway and other Western European democracies to see that just because people are in prison, there can be a more humane way of incarceration. Those are helpful discussions. But I also think what's helpful and what I hope advocates continue to call for is not disappearing people away, period, particularly for some of the punitive, in some of the very punitive ways that we do in the United States. Think life without parole and the death penalty are extreme sentences. And because they're so extreme, they set a baseline for what is viewed as legitimate sentences for very minor offenses in the United States. Earlier this year, there is a sentence that was affirmed in Mississippi, and we're not even at the end of January yet, so this is, you know, just a few weeks ago, that a sentence was affirmed in Mississippi for a man to serve a 12-year term for being in illegal possession of a cell phone in the county jail that he was booked into jail with. So it's not that he obtained the cell phone while incarcerated in the jail. He was actually booked into the jail with the cell phone, which means that the booking officers failed to do their job, and there was a lot of other failures along the way. And we can, you know, accept that perhaps there should be a legitimate sanction for this man, but the idea that he will now be disappeared away for 12 years for being in illegal possession of a cell phone after he was booked into the local county jail in Mississippi is inhumane and a reflection of how extreme our sentencing practices are.
That is terrible. That is. There's a lot going on in Mississippi right now with the prison there, but that's as you said, the people that that brought him in, they should have done their job. But to give him 12 years, that's awful.
It is awful. I mean, there might have been a response for a jail detainee, you know, to be in possession of that cell phone. But the idea that response is 12 years is absolutely inhumane. And that sentence was affirmed by the state Supreme Court. There was a dissenting opinion of a state Supreme Court judge who acknowledged that the sentence was possible under the Mississippi Criminal Code because of that state's habitual offender statute, otherwise known as three strikes in, you know, California and other states, but that the underlying circumstances of the crime call into question the discretion that was used in charging that gentleman with an offense that could lead to that 12-year sentence, including whether or not the jailers did what they needed to do to remove, to take the phone away when he was booked into the jail, and also other circumstances that, you know, should be looked at. The reality is that the district attorney had discretion how to charge that offense. And the judge had, you know, should have had discretion as well. The original sentencing judge had some discretion as well. So while the Mississippi Criminal Code allows a 12-year sentence for someone with prior offenses, even though that third offense was a, you know, possession of a cell phone while in a county jail, it's still an unacceptable sentence for a range of reasons, including the fact that that man is now going to be separated from his family for years, and he has minor children, and you know, there's a range of other reasons why it's not a legitimate, it's not a humane sentence, even if it might be a legitimate one.
I don't believe this country is humane. I hate to say it, but in comparison to other countries, this country is a country of hatred, of racism. It's a country of vengeance, retaliation, and there is no excuse for it, because I know, again, people have lost loved ones. But as far as the three strikes law, I think that was ridiculous. That started in California, and I remember working with a prisoner in California who said he was serving a life for a three strikes, and it was robbery, unarmed robbery. One was a department store and a couple of other minor things. But to get life sentences for something like that, it's ridiculous. But I admire Governor Newsom, because he's been releasing prisoners who have been serving life. And I believe right now he's the first state to start it. And Pennsylvania, as you said, Pennsylvania is doing a lot of work right now, too, with lifers.
Yes. Yeah, there's active legislation to scale back the use of life without parole in that state. There's great community support that's growing in Pennsylvania, and that's already, you know, a strong showing of community support with state coalitions, Coalition Against Death by Incarceration and Decarcerate PA. These groups have organized hundreds of people to go to Harrisburg, the capital of Pennsylvania, to show popular and public support to end life without parole as a sentencing option. Much of that work and activism is fueled by the family members of people disappeared away by these death by incarceration sentences, these life without parole sentences, and also former lifers who are now out in the community who are working to help the people they left behind and who haven't been able to benefit because of, you know, changes in the law in Pennsylvania. So there's a lot of work going on there, as there is in other states around the country too.
This is a big problem, because there was a recent incident, as I mentioned, I think briefly yesterday, with one of the prisons in Massachusetts where six to eight prisoners jumped a guard. What I later learned by the family of another prisoner was that these prisoners have been, and I know this for a fact, it's happened in other situations, prisoners have been crying out for help. They're serving a life sentence. Many of them have tried to get, you know, work prison jobs. Many of them have tried to get educational correspondence courses. They're trying to do whatever they can to show that they are being productive while incarcerated. And they're being denied, deprived. When this riot broke out, I was hearing about it on the news, and one of the officials at the prison said that these prisoners need to get a job in the prison. They need to start doing something to show, you know, that they're doing something. Well, when I heard that, I was really furious, because I know prisoners have tried and they have prevented them. So it's a prevention to keep them from progressing, so that when they have an opportunity, hopefully, to be able to go before the parole board, they don't have anything to show.
Yes. Yeah. And I think one way to get to address that is, even though it may be hard, but there is a lot of resilience happening behind the wall, which we're so encouraged by and want to figure out ways to support, you know, in the free community. But the level of leadership happening within prison walls, particularly amongst people sentenced to life because they're excluded from in-prison programming, does happen and is encouraging. And I think there's work to be done to support that and to encourage that when it can and does happen. So one thing that the Sentencing Project has done is, you know, my colleagues here published a book at the end of 2018 that's helped to launch our national campaign around ending life imprisonment, and that book is called The Meaning of Life, The Case for Abolishing Life Sentences, and it was written by my colleagues Mark Maurer and Ashley Nellis. Yes. And we sent in 2,000 copies of these books to people inside And that's helped to, you know, support discussion groups and conversations for folks sentenced to life and who are directly impacted by these sentences. And then we've encouraged folks to share feedback with us. And so we've been getting letters and communication from currently sentenced life prisoners who have a great deal of clearly insight because, you know, they are living these experiences, and then also suggestions and ideas for ways to, you know, call attention to the sentencing practice and the experiences that they're going through and have gone through. And, you know, book groups and discussion groups inside for lifers is one step. And then there's also other programming that lifers have created themselves because they're excluded from formal prison programming. And even though it doesn't happen a lot, you know, there are opportunities for lifers to seek commutations. And when they do seek commutation, you know, despite how unfair it is, they're expected to show how they demonstrated rehabilitation, you know, when they are able to apply for a commutation or they do seek that review, even though they go into prison, and many times those opportunities are limited to them. And so even though there's this exclusion from formal prison programming, creating programs and creating spaces inside and figuring out ways to support that can help, you know, people excluded from these programs to demonstrate their attempts at rehabilitation when those opportunities to, you know, do come up. So I'll just say I know it's really unfair given the limitations that the system imposes on, you know, people sentenced to these extreme sentences, but to not lose hope and to still be fighting for participation in something, even if it's something that, you know, people have to create themselves. And then what groups like the Sentencing Project have tried to do is support those efforts through, you know, providing access to resources, written resources that we can share with people inside. And one of the most recent things that we've done around that is sharing the book that my colleagues have published inside.
And can you repeat the name of the book and where they can be found?
So the name of the book is called The Meaning of Life, The Case for Abolishing Life Sentences, and it can be found through your independent bookseller and through the publisher, The New Press. So people can just Google The New Press, and they can purchase it directly from the book publisher.
Okay, great. And I was also going to say there is some of the prisoners in Massachusetts did form, and this was quite a few years ago, the Lifers Group, and that was formed out of Norfolk Prison in Massachusetts. They formed the Lifers Group, and it's spread, and more people are getting involved. And Gordon Haas and I think Timothy Mills were at least two of them that established that, initiated that book. They have done that. And as far as commutations, pardons, or whatever, there are so many of those on the governor's desk, and they're not only with this governor, but forwarded from the previous governors. So that's been an issue with the pardons and the commutations. No one's
yeah.
willing to take a chance.
Yeah, it is a challenge. You know, we know that these are hard conversations to deal with and to actually see action on. All I can say is that the work that we're doing every day, the conversations like this one, you know, continuing to call on governors and other, you know, stakeholders and officials to act and to do something and to continue to bring people together and to demonstrate support that, you know, governors do act on pardons and commutations, that people do, you know, give opportunities for lifers like Gordon and others to be engaging in programming inside of prison, and also to change the laws to give people a meaningful opportunity for a review, that, you know, continuing to create space for these conversations will hopefully lead to change. And, you know, I think it can be, you know, challenging to continue to engage in this and to know how much resistance there is to action. And yet I think that there's a growing movement. I think that I have seen, you know, new voices come into this discussion, and hopefully that new energy will continue to spur action. And at some point, governors in Massachusetts and in other states will be responding to the energy that's evident in the community, and will hopefully approve commutations, but also there will be legal changes that make it possible for lifers and others to have some relief.
Yeah. I noticed that you had given a number of talks with the League of Women's Voters, and I was going to say we did have an opportunity to go before some of the legislative members at the State House a few months back, and it was interesting. And there were women from the League of Voters there, and there were quite a few. It was a nice turnout, but they only allowed everyone to speak maybe 3 minutes, 2 or 3 minutes, which to me is, when it comes to things like this, people should be allotted a little bit more time. But we had that opportunity. I wanted to ask what kind of feedback you get when you do these speaking and doing these talks with the NAACP and United Methodist Women's Assembly and League of Women's Voters. Do you find a positive response or doubtful? How does it work with that?
Well, I mean, I think I'm invited into spaces where people are supportive of these conversations. I think that it's encouraging that groups like the League of Women Voters and the NAACP, and, you know, these are membership-based groups, so the conversations have looked different in Kentucky and St. Louis or Michigan and California when I've gone to speak to national organizations that have different state chapters or state organizations. I think that there's a lot of support in general around ending mass incarceration. I think the challenge comes to specifics and, you know, calling for reforms that might challenge people's notion of what an adequate response to, you know, serious offenses are. I think there's a lot of support in general around, you know, changing drug laws, particularly for drug possession and drug use. But when it comes to more serious offenses where somebody may have been convicted of a murder or a robbery, you know, then those offenses and reforms for that end of the system can be really challenging. I do think that there's support for that, because I think that people are getting more informed around these discussions, but I think that in general those conversations can I think there's a lot more work for us to do, even when we go talk to organizations like the NAACP or League of Women Voters to inform people about how punitive our responses are to crime and why that, you know, they're more extreme here than they are in other parts of the world, particularly other Western democracies.
We're going to be running out of time real soon, but you know what, Nicole, I don't know if you'd be willing to, but I'd love to have you come back on again. I'd like to talk more about the parole reform and also prosecutional misconduct, some of these issues that caused them to get life in the first place. Again, like I say, there's a lot of wrongfully convicted inside. There's a lot of, like you say, three strikes law. There are also the victims before becoming offenders. There's so many, and I'd like to talk more about it with you if you'd be willing to come back on again.
Sure, I would be happy to come back on. I am traveling over the next couple of months, so I don't know that I'll be able to do it soon, but certainly reach back out to me and we can schedule a time to do that.
I would love that.
And
okay, thank
I just
you
encourage
so much
people,
for being on.
Oh, you're welcome. And I'll just encourage people to visit us online at sentencingproject.org. And I know you have a lot of incarcerated listeners as well, so feel free to reach out to us through, you know, the U.S. mail, and we're happy to follow up.
Thank you so, so much. I really appreciate your taking the time to be on the air with us. And again, I will be definitely in touch with you when you get back or sometime in between. And we'd love to have you come on. And as I mentioned yesterday, I'd like to talk to some of the advocates to see if they would be willing to, if we can come up with some kind of solution to bring you and your colleague out here, because you have a wealth of information and you're very experienced in what you've been doing. Thank you so much, Nicole. Ms. Porter is now going to be checking out. We thank you, and we hope to talk and have you back on with us real soon.
Okay, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.